KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today I'm very excited to have with me my colleague from Elon, Professor Megan Squire, who is working on and just beginning to work on a really interesting project involving looking at how open source coders and programmers communicate. Megan's work spans a very interesting range that Hearsay Culture listeners will be particularly interested in. For those of you that listen regularly, you know that increasingly communications has become a focus on the show because of media policy as well as information policy that increasingly becomes more complex even as we talk about it more. But we've also focused from day one on technology issues, and occasionally we've even talked about anthropological studies of coding communities. So most recently, Biela Coleman was on the show talking about her work involving the hacker community in San Francisco and the open source community there. And so I'm very excited to have my colleague from Elon, Megan, here to talk about her new work focusing on an enormous and interesting data set that she's compiled and her preliminary take on what is going on. Particularly in an era and particularly in a time where we're recording the show on November 12th, 2014, there's been interesting and unfortunate and rather troublesome problems associated with communication in the gaming community, what has been known as Gamergate. There's been also increasing, I think appropriately, discussion within the STEM areas looking at why we have still problems recruiting and keeping women in the field. And so there's a lot of interesting demographic questions, sociological questions that go into this data. Having listened and talked to Megan about this data set a bit in a communications and technology scholars group that has been put together at Elon, I know that this data set will ultimately reveal lots of interesting insights that can be useful as we understand how to build communities that actually work together well and how we can get the most from an innovation policy out of people that are doing this hard work. This kind of empirical analysis is what's needed to get to that point, and so I'm excited to have Megan here. For those of you listening very closely and not just the engineering and audio nerds that listen to the show, and I know you're out there and you could admit it, you'll notice that you have an echoey sound here, and that's because Megan drove over to what I have euphemistically called the East Coast studios of KZSU. The FCC should not get nervous about that. KZSU does not have any transmission equipment or anything else operating in Greensboro, North Carolina. Nonetheless, that euphemism means we are sitting in my dining room here in Greensboro, North Carolina. Megan, having driven over from the main campus of Elon University, which is in Burlington, about 20 miles or so east of Greensboro. So she is joining me here in my dining room, and we're going to have the discussion in a moment. For those of you that aren't familiar with Megan, she got her undergrad degree from the College of William & Mary. She has a PhD in computer science. She came to Elon in 2003, where she's in the Department of Computing Sciences. She teaches database systems, web development, and data mining courses. And her research is at the intersection of software engineering, data mining, and open source software. Incredibly fortunate timing and exciting timing. Just today, Megan signed a book contract for a book called Clean Data, which is one which is certainly very important and very procedural, focusing on how you keep your data sets both clean and tidy, which anyone who's worked with data sets knows is incredibly difficult and incredibly important. So Megan is joining us today again in Greensboro, North Carolina, on November 12, 2014. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
No problem. Wow, what an intro.
my pleasure. So, Megan, let's start off. And I do this for colleagues. I do this for others. You know, it's just part of what you get when you're on Hearsay Culture.
Awesome.
All right. So let's start off here. Tell us, I've given you a bit of an introduction, but let's talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in studying open source coders.
Okay. So I was in software industry before coming into academia, and I kind of did my grad school part-time, nighttime, all the time. But I worked during the day and then kind of did my school stuff at night. So I was very much immersed in the whole first generation .com startup thing. I did four or five startups, one after the other. And so software development to me, it's the first love. It's I'm familiar with it. I enjoy it. I worked in it. So that was something I was very familiar with. When I decided to transition into academia, I, of course, needed a research agenda, and I was trained in data mining. And so it seemed obvious to me to turn my data mining skills to this thing that I had worked in and known and loved, which was also phenomenological at the time. I mean, open source was not exactly new, but the study, systematic study of it was sort of new. And this is in the early 2000s, late 90s. So the first project that I decided to work on in earnest was just applying some new data mining techniques to this group that I felt like I knew.
And this group being, and maybe you could describe it for those that aren't familiar, many Hearsay Culture listeners, in fact, may be part of this community, but certainly are familiar. But for those that aren't, describe what this community is. What are, and of course, that's what your data gets at. Who are they? But let's start at the top level.
So I guess there's then and now, too, to layer another level on this. So open source then, at the time when I started studying it, was typically project-based. It was decoders who came together to solve some kind of problem, tried to recruit more members to the team. They would write some code to solve some problem or other and then release that code in a public way, usually using the internet, with a license attached to the code that specified usage parameters and derivatives and things like this, derivative works. And so that license sets open source software separately from other types of software, maybe software made by a company that you're not allowed to change or make derivative works of. So that was interesting. It was how do you get people who aren't maybe affiliated through a company or who don't even live in the same place or have never met each other, aren't in the same time zone, have no boss in common and no financial remuneration. How do you get them to work together? How does all of that happen so that we can have these products like Linux and Apache and Mozilla and some of the early software projects that were considered free or open source software? So that's that was the early years. People that were in software like I was were using that software every day, really needing it actually to start companies and maintain companies and get our jobs done. And so to me, that was just a really fascinating thing, a fascinating set of questions to study how all of that goes down. Now, of course, 10, 15, 20 years later, open source looks very different. So studying that whole time period, some of the questions are the same. You know, how does it work? How do you make money? But some of the questions are very, very different. The why do you participate and who participates questions we start to see are very, very different now as opposed to early years. There's more corporate participation now. People do get paid. It can be your whole job to work for an open source project now, and that would have been a little bit more unusual in the earlier years. So gathering that data and collecting those facts and then watching those changes over time is pretty interesting.
The community we're talking about, right, is a community that has a lot of stereotypes attached to it, right? We think we know what let me put it differently. We have an image in our mind of what a programmer looks like, right? What a coder looks like. And again, these stereotypes can operate in ways that cause us to reach conclusions that may or may not be accurate. When you think about looking through this kind of data, right, before we get to those stereotypes, which I kind of want to tie it into, what exactly is the data that you have? What is the data set and how did you collect it?
Yeah, so what I decided to do at the beginning when I first started looking, I went to the easiest places to get data because you got to start somewhere. So I went to the lowest hanging fruit. There was a bunch of, at the time, a lot of software projects were self-hosted, so you would make a project and then you would buy the domain name for the project and you would put it on your website. Mm-hmm. But at some point people decided, well, it might be easier if we don't all have these like separate websites and try to do all this hosting. It's very distracting trying to, you know, as you know, keep track of your software updates. Yes. And stop hacking and all of this sort of thing. So why don't we outsource that piece of it? And so this idea of a software forge came about. And this is a sort of a website where a bunch of projects come and they use the central features of the Forge. It's a lot like website hosting, actually. So you might say, oh, I want a mailing list for my project, and I want a wiki, and I want to have file downloads, and you guys will maintain all that, and we'll just run the project. Okay. So I decided to get data first from those forges, because there was a lot of software projects using those services, and the data was very exposed in a way that I could easily get it. So I wrote some scripts that would just go out and grab data from those websites, pull it down, and then I could analyze it a little bit. And I found out really quickly that the websites weren't very easy to scrape to collect the data from. Well, actually, they were really easy, but they were changing all the time. So great, it's easy, but then next week you have to completely rewrite your code because they changed the way the website looked. So that was awkward. We don't have a lot of those problems now for other reasons, but the data that I was getting, though, was kind of shallow. It was data about the projects. It wasn't necessarily the source code itself or the communication artifacts that the programmers used, you know, the actual words that they used. It was things about the project. So when was it registered? What's the name of it? How many people are working on it? What's programming language? Stuff like that. But I plugged along, and it turned out there were other people that were collecting the same types of data, and we formed teams and, you know, sort of worked together. I also learned that I wasn't that great of a data, I'm a good data miner, but I'm not that great of a data analyst. Like there's people that are really, really good at that job. And so what I decided to work on for my, to be good, you know, to actually provide a service to the community was to collect the data and work really hard at collecting and cleaning and, and providing access to the data. And conveniently, it turns out that that actually has a name. It's called infrastructure. So I'm data infrastructure. I collect all the data, write these scripts, write programs to keep it all neat and tidy. I label it all and like curate it, you know, like a library, right? So I do that and I like it. I'm pretty good at that. And it also turns out that that's the kind of work that a lot of people don't like to do. So it gives me a little, it's kind of like a niche. So I make data sets, I make data, big databases full of all this kind of stuff. As of now, the types of things that I've collected are not just the metadata, like I was describing, you know, the sort of facts about projects, but also communication artifacts. So that would be like emails and IRC chat logs and tweets about projects or about open source software developers themselves. We also have a fair amount of other types of documents, like requirements documents or source code, bug reports, things like that. So depending on what you want to study, you can get different artifacts and use them, chop them up, rearrange them in different ways.
The data set itself covers geographically, demographically, across the board. I mean, what are or put it differently? Yeah, go ahead.
It's really scattershot. Yeah. So let me start with numbers and then we'll try to break it down. So there's really, you say data set, but there's really 43,000 different sets of data that I have that I have to keep track of. And those are
43,000
sets. Yeah. Like, and so there's many terabytes of data once you get, so keeping all that organized is a challenge. But then within, you know, within that, so what do you have? Well, like I said, sometimes I start with what's easy.
Go ahead.
So it doesn't always make a lot of sense. Or I'll have a project that I want and I'll collect the data to answer that. Or sometimes someone will ask me, can you get me this data? And I'll go get it and then, you know, keep it. Yeah. But like, that doesn't happen enough. That needs to happen a lot more, because otherwise you're getting my sort of ADD. Hey, let me go get this data. Let me go get that. Let me go get this. And then I just keep hoarding it and like, It is like hoarding them. Which is funny because you go into my house and it's like completely sparse. You know, it's like Pottery Barn and there's nothing. But my databases are a little crazy. So so there's a variety both in where I got the stuff, which projects it talks about, what projects am I interested in at the time. Even project families. So for a while, for a couple of years, I was really interested in the Apache family of projects. So I had all this stuff on the Apache. And then I went kind of into Debian. I was doing all this Debian stuff. And then now I've got a student who's interested in the Linux kernel. So we're doing all this Linux kernel stuff. So it's a little bit all over. Part of the purpose of the grant that I just got is to integrate some of that and try to make it a little more sensible. Also, I mentioned that I had some collaborators at other universities to pull their data in so that it makes more of a story. And it's a little less crazy. We have a blessing of a lot of data, but that's also a curse.
Well, I was going to say, and so that the blessing of that data is backed up by what you just referred to, which I want to ask you about. And we're chatting with Professor Megan Squire of Elon University on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So you modestly referred to that grant, but why don't you tell us a little bit more about that grant, which backs up the work that we're going to talk about now.
Yeah, so that infrastructure that I mentioned, that data, building that data infrastructure, it's not that hard. I mean, it's me and some undergrads, you know, our little army, and then, of course, these other colleagues at other universities and their armies, and we're collecting data, and we're pulling it in and storing it in databases. That's not really rocket science, right? It's pretty manageable. But the volume and the velocity of that data can be a little bit challenging. Also, the various types, the variety of the data, trying to make that make sense is the job of infrastructure. So that's what I got the grant for. There's a couple of NSF programs that are specifically designed to help science, you know, the science community build this type of infrastructure. So I was fortunate to apply for one of those in 2007 with some colleagues, and we got that one. That was with Syracuse University. And then this one, which is just Elon only, this one is a little bit bigger, and it's also a little bit more targeted than the first grant. This one has some specific riders, I don't know what you'd call it, but specific outcomes that need to come for text mining specifically. So I'm a little bit putting some of that metadata collection on the back burner, and now I'm really looking at the text artifacts, so email, IRC chat, which brings me to the questions about communicating. And when you have email and IRC chats, the natural questions that you can ask are, well, what are they talking about? You know, what are the conversational patterns? What are the social networks that develop around communication and stuff like that? So I'm just trying to collect all that and clean it up so that the good analysts can answer those questions, but they'll have clean and nice data to do so.
You know, one thing, Megan, you mentioned, and it's related to this point with regard to grants, but not directly, but I want to ask you, there's been a lot of writing there's been some writing and commentary about how difficult it is for researchers to get grants for any scientific research, much less empirical studies. So, you know, congratulations on getting it. Do you have any comments on that? I mean, what your experience, particularly since you applied in 2007, which my understanding is was a very different time even than now. Any comments on the relative difficulty to get grants these days, or anything you'd like to say about it, having been someone who's successfully gotten to?
Yeah, and I mean, these are small ones. Like I said, I'm working with undergrads. We don't have a graduate program, so I feel like I'm fairly inexpensive. Like, the stuff that I'm asking for isn't, you know, it's not the huge dollar ones. In fact, between those two grants, of course, I'm putting in more grants with different colleagues and different teams, and none of those were successful. I don't go around talking about the unsuccessful ones, but there was a long string of not successful grants in there as well. And some of those had really high price tags. So to be honest, my strategy for this one, this last one, was to really come in very inexpensive.
Now, for those that aren't familiar, what would, in your experience, is a high price tag for a research grant?
I mean, for infrastructure on open source software, where you kind of aren't buying anything and you're really just storing data in databases that are kind of commodity databases. Our big ones were, I think, over $1 million, and this little last one that I got was $250,000, $241,000, I think it was. So, but that's undergrads. It's a little bit of my summer money. It's not a little bit of hardware, some travel. It's really pretty much undergrad focused. I don't have grad students to pay with huge stipends and, you know, all of that. So you can get a lot for your money, I guess, if you hire, undergrad.
Well, you know, there's something about competition and undercutting your competition that's helpful. Although, you know, based upon what I've seen, which we're going to talk about now, I think this data should reveal some interesting results. In the presentation that I saw you do, Megan, you talked about the questions that you have that you'd like to answer. And you ran through a few of them. I could, frankly, do the rest of the interview and say, okay, tell me how software is made. Tell me how software can be better. But I'm not going to do that. But I do want to frame for the listeners the kinds of interest you have and concerns, and we can dig a little bit into them. So you do say, you know, among the questions you want to answer is how software is made, how software can be made both better and more efficient, how it can be higher quality, how it can be lower cost, how it can be more fun. how groups work, how decisions are made, how developers talk to each other. Now, that range of questions yeah. is quite broad.
It's kind of a lot.
It is a lot. It's ambitious, but they're terrific questions. Perhaps let's start here. As I was thinking about how best to approach this, it seems like you have two kinds of questions, right? You have the hard technology, right? Geek. We want to build a product. We want to build a service. We want to do something and build it out of code. How do we do that, mm-hmm. right? The technological side of it. And then you really do have the social and group side of it, right? Before we even get into data, right, based upon your experience and the work you've done, what do you see is the relationship between group dynamics and the effectiveness of software? Is it one that where there is a direct relationship between how well a group works together, or is it siloed? Right? Do the communications impact again top level? Obviously, that question you're going to spend a few years studying. But as you start off here, how do you begin thinking through that question?
Yeah, that's a huge question, and you're absolutely right. First of all, there are those two ways of dividing the question, and typically people in my line of work, we like to focus a lot more on the software engineering questions. Mm-hmm. So the how many bugs were fixed? How long did it take you to fix these bugs? How much, you know, where are the function points, and how many of them are there? And we may use the communication artifacts, email, for example, to point to those or to illuminate that type of question, but we're still very much down in the source code. We're looking at bug reports, things like that, trying to speed it up, make it cheaper, make it better. The socio-technical questions, the ones where you have social questions embedded in a technical community, that is a little bit, well, it's a lot messier, right? And it's also, sometimes you'll get people that I'm a software engineer. I'm a, you know, coder. I'm a data miner, stuff like that. I'm not necessarily trained in communication and socio-technical studies. So that requires making a team. And I sometimes need to step back and say, you know what? It's not my job to answer that question. I think that's a question. I'm pretty sure I heard you guys say that was a question. But my job is to make you an awesome data set that's going to help you answer that question. Now, there's some back and forth because I need to know if I'm providing what's actually going to answer it, or if I could organize the data in a better way or clean it or get a better source, things like that. But I don't know what that answer is going to be. I don't even know I don't even know the right ways to go about studying it. I can guess some ways to start, but I don't know what's going to end up being the winner. I really don't.
When you talk about, so when you think about clean data, right, in the context of this work, right, again, for people who don't work with data, right, you alluded to it, right? I mean, organization matters. But when we're talking about a 43,000 data set collective, now I'm not even sure, maybe you have to tell me what you call that. What does it mean to clean that? What does that entail to then be able to get to answer the questions that you've posed?
Well, yeah, so cleaning typically happens after we collect it. That seems really obvious, but so first we figure out what we're going to get and we go get it. And either as the data is coming in or right after we get it, we'll have to clean it and organize it in some way. So let's take a really messy data set like email. Email's pretty messy. So I might have a mailing list. Let's say the Linux kernel mailing list. That's a really popular one to study. It's been studied, you know, hundreds of times in the literature. It's also a really big data set. We have almost 20 years of emails. There's a lot going on with it. Each individual email has both a clean part and a messy part. The clean part we'll call the headers. This is like to, from, subject, date. It's very easy to parse out and like organize that and keep that part tidy. You know what the headers are going to be mostly. Even if there's a new header you've never seen before, at least it's delineated and you can find it. The body of the message, though, and all of the attachments and stuff, that's the gross, messy part. And it's gross and messy because it's text, but there's different character formattings. There's all these attachments put on there. You don't know what's inside there. There's regular natural language, like, you know, words, sentences, mixed in with source code and links and images and jokes and emoticons and like all this crap all mashed around. So when you're writing a program to try to analyze all of that, you know, you want to write some machine learning. Let's classify this or some kind of program to analyze that data. Even to count, how many lines long is this or whatever? you've got to clean all that up and put those various pieces into different buckets, or not. You have to decide how I'm going to treat the message and then put it in, physically put it in the right format to do that. So that's very exhausting work.
Yeah, sounds
good. It's very not fun. It's also, it's the kind of thing that, like, you want, you know, oh man, give it, I wish I had some grad students work. You know, like, give it to somebody so they can do it, and I can get to the, you know, sexy fun stuff, which is analyzing it and coming up with the, you know, the Squire algorithm for blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to sit there for like hours and hours and write, you know, cleaning routines.
Yeah.
And yet, time and time again, we see that that is the job. That's, you're a data miner. You're going to be cleaning some data. So I thought what my value could be was, you know, doing that once and then providing the clean data out for all the other people to use it. So we don't have to waste our time. Everybody's cycling, cleaning.
Right.
Let one person clean and everybody gets to use it.
Which is an open source concept, it would seem. And I wonder, go ahead.
I mean, that's what, you know, I think in the industry, it's drinking your own champagne or eating your own dog food or whatever gross thing you want to do. But using the principles of the people we're studying, I guess that's a little self-serving in a way. But when we first started this project, floss mole is the umbrella term for the
project. And what does that mean?
Floss mole. So floss is free Libre and open source software. Mm-hmm. It also makes a nice word,
mm-hmm.
Other than FOSS and OSS. Those aren't words, but FLOSS is a word, so people can say it.
Right.
And then mole, we added the mole because moles dig, and we have a lot of data, and so we wanted a little creature that can dig. Looking back, though, we have our cute animal mascot and all that, but moles are also blind, and they're like work in the dark and stuff. So, I don't know. If I had to pick it again, I might not choose the same animal mascot. But in any event, it is what it is. We've had it for 10 years, and we're not getting rid of it. So the moles dig through all of this data. And that's what we do.
And now, before we take a very short break, again, and we're gonna talk about the data and some of your preliminary takes on it in a moment. Free Libre open source.
Right.
Very quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Very quickly. Yeah, it's here at Say Culture, so you have a few minutes. It's not a 10-second. What are the differences? I mean, at the top level, what's the difference between free, open, and Libre?
Okay, so I'm going to put my hip boots on and wade into this one. So
yeah,
if you follow the, you know, this culture, as long as I have, some of these words are loaded. Well, let me start with Libre because that's the easy one. We added Libre, or a lot of people added it, to make a word, but also because in the European languages, Romance languages, Libre means free, freedom, not mm-hmm. free cost. So gratis and Libre are the two words for free. So we added Libre for that. But the difference between free and open free happened first. Free software was the movement, of course, started by Richard Stallman, or not started by, but codified in a bunch of documents that he wrote back in the 80s for why software and, you know, that sort of intellectual work should be free, as in freedom,
right.
Free for people to use and modify and change and so on and so forth. In the later 90s, there was a little bit of pushback from some people in the business community about the word free, and that maybe that word wasn't as descriptive of what was really going on or what should be going on with this type of licensed software, and that maybe a word that was more, I don't know, business friendly, I guess, something like open, mm-hmm. open source, would be more descriptive of what was actually going on. So now I don't really, I don't have a dog in that fight. I'm just, to use a crass metaphor, I'm just happy if I have any kind of data. So about this entire process, whatever they want to call themselves. One thing that's interesting, though, if we compare, you know, sort of, I mentioned the 80s and the 90s, and that phrase, free, Libre, and open, is, you know, a little bit older. Something that's happening now, though, in FLOSS, but it's not really in FLOSS, but in this type of software development, is a newer phenomenon. It's happening on GitHub, which is one of these newer style forges. I mentioned software forges earlier. GitHub's a place where a lot of software developers are putting code. And GitHub, unlike some of the other free software forges or open source software forges like SourceForge and RubyForge and Launchpad and things like that that came before them, even Google Code, GitHub does not require that you pick one of the open source licenses when you sign up and put your code there. So a large amount of code, and I mean GitHub dwarfs every other forge in its size and the amount of code that's there. this massive amount of code since 2009 is being put on this place that appears to be freely accessible and open to anyone to come and look. But most of the code that's there is not licensed. So I think someone did a study a couple years ago, and it was maybe 19% of the code actually had a license on it. So there was quite a bit of hand-wringing. Oh, no, the youngsters these days are putting their code all out there, and they're not putting a license on it. What are we going to do? Because it's not really free and open if you don't put a license on it. So there was quite a bit of back and forth about that, and this is maybe down in the weeds a little bit, but it does affect what I do and what I study, because I don't know right now if I should go and worry about GitHub code or not, if I should go get it and study it very much. It's obviously the place where things are happening, but I can't say without reservation that that's a place for free and open, because it isn't. It's a place for what it is, which is available, right? And maybe free of charge, maybe. Certainly available code, but I don't know if it's free or open the way we typically would have defined it. So we're in a little bit of a funny place right now, trying to figure all that out.
And of course, you know, it parallels the broader issues we have with monetizing the open source community, which of course has been going on for a while. We're chatting with Professor Megan Squire at Elon University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu to make a donation. You can also go to our webpage, go to donate to KZSU. Either way, we hope that you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture as well as listen to KZSU. So Megan, let's talk a bit more about these questions, and also we can talk a bit about the existing research that's out there to which you refer. You know, as I look at the questions that you have there, let's put aside, you know, as you indicated earlier, the sociological ones for a moment, right? And think about what kinds of conclusions we might be able to draw from a data set, or excuse me, a massive quantity of information, you know, as yet unnamed. Big data? Is it big data? No, it's not even big data. Here's where radio's helpful, but here's also where being in person, you know, face to face person. I saw you grimace at the phrase big data. Maybe I misread it, but the interviewer that I am, and this is the benefit of having you here. Why the grimace?
Well, everybody wants to have big data, and I've heard everything from, you know, big data is anything that won't fit in an Excel spreadsheet, to, you know, big data has to meet all these, the five V's, volume, velocity, veracity, all this stuff. You know. So everyone's trying to define that. I don't care. I'm just, you know, if it helps me get a grant or something, sure, it's big data. But I always hate to, you know, kind of oversell and brag or act like, you know, buzzword, right? Like, it is what it is. I'll tell you the amounts if I know them, but sometimes I actually don't even know how big the stuff is, because it's mirrored across three places. And
That sounds even more impressive than big data. I was going to say, it's so big, it's not even big.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah. This is a true fact. We don't know how many open source projects there are. That's a number that we don't have. Huh. We can guess. I can make estimates. My husband's an astrophysicist, and we sat down and tried to do a Drake equation for open source. How many, you know, if there were to be an equation that would give us an estimate for open source, where would we get it? And we realized that there was no sense in measuring, you know, most of the places where open source lives, because GitHub drowns out all of their noise. Mm-hmm. You know, we can just measure the size of that and get an estimate. We don't have even answers to simple things.
That's interesting. From a data perspective, why is that? I mean, why is it?
Because they don't have to register anywhere.
Yeah, okay, so it's literally because there are no formalities necessary to indicate that you're a group.
I mean, if you said how many corporations are there, you would go to each state and you'd pull their documents and you'd count them up. Well, how many open source projects? I don't know. I mean, you'd have to go to what I did, go to all the forges, count those. Try to go to some independent places. Well, I'll go out to Linux kernel. I'll go out to Apache. I'll go count and so you end up with kind of a count, but you never really know if that's the count. You also aren't sure which projects count as projects. So my, you know, undergrad senior thing that I put out on GitHub before I graduated, and, you know, it's 10,000 lines of code, and then I never touched it again. Does that count? Is it dead? Is it alive? How do we measure if it's even still a viable project?
Is there, which ties in, I mean, it's useful that you're talking about this because, you know, when I think about something like efficiency, all right, I mean, I think about it from, you know, we all have our perspectives. I think about it from a law and regulatory perspective, right, and how we create a system of rules and responsibilities and rights that pushes people in a direction of whatever we think is efficient. But of course, that's the question, right? What is a measurement of efficiency? How would, and again, I recognize, and again, I want to emphasize, early days, right? You're still putting the data, you're trying to organize the data at this point, much less reach conclusions. So I'm merely asking for any working hypotheses you might have. What would you hope to see out of the data without, again, prejudging it, right? Or what would you expect to see out of the data that would indicate how software could be made more efficient, right? Which is question two. Because really, the first question is define efficiency for us from a software perspective.
So I'll bounce this back to the previous way where you divided the questions into two pieces. There's the software engineering efficiency. So this is my code runs 30% faster after this patch than before, you know, something like that, or it doesn't have these three bugs that it used to have or whatever. So there's that kind of code level efficiency. We could extend that maybe to an efficiency of process around software code as well. We could say, well, bugs used to get, you know, they used to take a week to fix, but now they only take 3 days. So that's a type of efficiency. It's still around the code, but it's not the source code itself. I didn't measure, you know, how many loops did I need this week versus last week. I measured how fast were my bugs getting fixed. The next extension from that would probably be to look at the process efficiency in the from a people point of view. So how are the people communicating? How are they? How is their workflow more efficient? That actually is really messy, but that's probably where where this grant work is going to end up taking me a little bit because I am focusing so much more on text and communication artifacts. But if I wanted, if that didn't seem to be producing anything, we could back off to bug reports or other ways of looking at an efficiency question using text or source code. We have metrics that we strive for as software engineers or software developers, things that we try for, you know, reduce this, increase that, try to not do this. We have rules, you know, guidelines and rules. And then there's also official metrics that people use to try to measure software, from the really simple ones like how many lines of code is it to, you know, the complexity measures and things like that. And so we can look at a body of work, body of code, and calculate metrics for it. And you can do that at, you know, in your own company with your own product or software product, or I can do it from the outside looking at your code. There's been a couple of businesses that have started up, well, a couple of dozens probably, that are designed to help both proprietary and open source groups, software making groups, make their code better. So a couple of buddies of mine from Spain working on a project now called Biturgia, and they do exactly that. They, from the outside, you know, an outsider's perspective, they look in at your processes and your communication and your source code, and they try to tell you if you're, you know, how it's going. And they do that with graphs and charts and metrics and other things like that. So
a lot of these efficiency questions turn on some of those demographic points, I think, that we referred to earlier, right? You know, if we, you know, if we think about, and again, I don't want to push too much on the sociological aspects of this, except to ask you, you know, what I think I would be remiss not to, right? You had talked about, and I'll ask you to flesh this out. You had talked about at least one group as composing in the previous talk I saw you present, 98.5% of the individuals were male, right? Now you can correct that and classify it, you know, for me, but, you know, I do want to ask you, this question from your perspective, as even if that number is high, it's not that far off from what I've read and heard, particularly about the CS, the computer science community. As a woman, right, regardless of the fact that you have a PhD, that you do this work, putting all of that aside, which should make you part of a community, right? As a woman studying these communities, right, in your experience, how much do you see gender playing a role? And I'm not asking you based upon the data, because you're still working through it, part of it's a personal question, because the follow-up would be, do you expect to be able to get any insights? Is it an area worth getting insights about from the data you're working with? Any reactions to those questions?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting. There's been a bit in the news, and there were some things that happened on Linux kernel mailing list last summer, summer of 2013, that made me ask some questions about how dialogue was playing out, or if I could answer some of those sort of team structure questions using the data. And so I dabbled in that a little bit. I think it's really complex. I'll start off with the number that you said, 98.5. So 1.5% of open source developers are female. That was a result of that was the finding of one survey. There's been some other surveys that have given slightly higher numbers. In my own
higher numbers of females.
They usually rely on surveys, because not every project requires that you even use your name, a name, much less your own name or a real name.
So
a few of them do. Apache projects make you sign an agreement, stuff like that, to contribute, not to just use the code. But anyway, so there's a bit of a, we're not really sure that number either, that you get some mixed results. The worst case I've heard is the 1.5% female. The best case I've heard is in open source is maybe 10%-ish. Now, with that said, there's some projects that do a better job than others. That's worth studying. Why are these projects successful? What programs have they put in place? What's worked? What hasn't worked? And there's an enormous amount of energy being spent there, and that's fantastic and should keep happening. I would like to have those artifacts when it's all done. You know, I'll be in there like looking at the IRC and seeing it. How many times did they use these words versus these words? Right. So, like, again, I want to just get the data. So I think there's a lot of energy around just asking the question, making sure the question is right, trying to pull the correct numbers from the right places, trying to line all that up. At the end of the day, though, you've got people writing code and putting a license on it so that other people can riff off of that code. I mean, that's the job at the end of the day. And a lot of times we're getting that job done. It's a difficult, you know, it's a fun job, but it's a hard job. And so there's not a lot of time to sort of identify yourself and sort of, you know, pitch political stakes in the ground and stuff like that. You're trying to get this work done. So what I want to do is study and gather all the data and put it in the right place so that we can make sure that that job's getting done in a fair, effective way for everybody who signs up on a team to do something that crazy, you know, that they're able to participate in the way that they can and as effectively as they can. So, you know, I don't have a lot of answers yet on that. And yeah. I want to get them though.
Yeah, no, and that's the goal. And again, you know, I mean, it's fair to say that, you know, I invite you back on the show maybe a couple years from now, if not sooner, to, you know, talk about what you're finding. Do you have any, you know, working hypotheses about the data that you want to share at this point as you enter into, of course, you know, any good researcher is not going to prejudge the outcome, so I'm not asking for that. But you must have some hunches about what you think the data might reveal based upon your own experience and also having written and worked with other data sets, and based upon some of the interesting conclusions that you and your colleagues and others who are in the field have done. I'm going to leave it open as far as, you know, what you'd like to hypothesize on, but I'm curious if you have a few, or perhaps the ones you're most comfortable sharing right now.
Yeah, so one of the projects that was, I was actually just talking about it with a student before I came over here, is trying to discern team structure. Not from asking, how's your team organized? Who's the leader? Who's the boss? But trying to discern that from the artifacts that we have. Mm-hmm. So looking at the way people talk, and is the evidence of how people talk and how work actually gets done, does that match what you told me the structure was? Right? And so there's a lot of algorithms and a lot of methods that we can use to hammer that nail. We can build social networks from the artifacts. We can build social networks from what they told us it looked like and compare. We can do some text mining on the artifact, on the email artifacts or IRC artifacts, to find out who's actually talking, what are they talking about, what kinds of language are they using, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That's going to be very exciting. I would really like to be able to see I mean, this is a workplace, but it's an unusual workplace. And so I'd like to see what the data shows about how this supposedly non-hierarchical or semi-hierarchical workplace actually is organized, and can we tease out decision-making, who is leading, what leadership looks like in communication, stuff like that.
So from the kinds of data that you're working through, right? And by the way, I guess I should say, we have about roughly 8 minutes left, so this is what I call the unfair portion of the show,
oh, no.
Where I start asking questions that you may not have adequate time to answer, and then I ask them anyway.
Okay.
This is who I am. So I'm thinking about, you know, as you work through this data, and you have a lengthy slide deck that you've shared in presentations, looking at some of the research out there, right? It's interesting to note the names of some of those projects, right? Projects that you or others have worked on. So community joining and specialization in open source software innovation, a case study. That's one that you didn't work on, but three other professors did. Okay, gendered patterns of politeness in free libre open source software development. There's interesting conclusions that you point out from all of them. Exploring the role of outside organizations in free open source software projects. You worked on one which has some, you know, fun results involving, a bit of code, how Stack Overflow communities create quality postings. And then another one where you look at some of the words that are used. Yeah. So and
as
I,
the insults.
Yeah. And I was about to say right. And then you've got this one, which I wanted to ask you about because I would really not be doing my job as a journalist as we got to it. And I thank you for pointing me directly there. Right. So you and a colleague from Elon, Rebecca Gazda, floss as a source of profanity and insults. Collecting the data. Now, I believe this is an article that's forthcoming.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you about this as certainly, potentially high profile, certainly interesting result, and maybe not a result that will be typical of everything you come across. But you report, and now I'm going to quote you, and this is quoting
okay.
your slide. One interesting finding we did not put in the table, so you're referring to a table in the article, was that if we consider the entire collection, again, using large data sets, nearly 80 million email messages indexed by markmail.org for 8,800 different, mostly floss projects. Here's the punchline. There is no single individual who uses the words. Now, this is an FCC-regulated radio station, and so I need to say the words crap, and an expletive for crap. Thank you. In email more often than Linus Torvalds, right? Linus Torvalds, of course, being, you know, of GNU Linux. This is true for raw accounts as well as on a percentage basis, profanity per email sent. Okay. Tell us a bit about that result, aside from whatever conclusions we might try to draw or not want to draw about, you know, literally the founder of this community. What do you take from that obviously fun, right, interesting, you know, conclusion? As a researcher in this, what does that piece of information tell you?
All right, so backing up a little bit to the data source. So I'm tasked with building these data sets and building the infrastructure so that other people can analyze. I have ideas for how I might do analyses or I might do prototype analyses or whatever, but really I'm collecting data. So this paper, which I'm presenting in January, I did with my student, Becca. She's an undergrad, real good student if anybody's hiring. She's graduating. But we decided to use the artifacts that we had, so use Floss communication, to talk about and to make data sets for profanity, insults, gender stereotyping, and things like that. So we thought, well, this is a community. This is a workplace community. Let's use the communication artifacts to build data sets that other folks can use, other analysts can use to do text mining, classification, whatever. Let's say you're doing you want to build a classifier to learn how to discern double entendres or gender stereotypes. Download this data set, which has been carefully curated by me and Becca, that includes 500 gender stereotype comments from Floss software projects. So there's a market for data sets, and this is just one of them. In describing the data set that we made, we ran some simple calculations just to tell people what was inside there. And this, what you're looking at here, was one of them. So we downloaded the email from this source, and then we decided to build a profanity set from it. And as part of doing that, we were like, wow, this guy really likes these two particular words more than anyone else ever. So we found a few things. We also compared, you know, the second highest usage of those words by different people and compared numerically and things like that. We also built a data set full of setup lines to "that's what she said" jokes. So if you were trying to train a double entendre classifier, you could download our data set of appropriate setup lines for a double entendre. But we got all this from open source, and so I get communication. So I guess that says that it's a rich source, but it's probably not the richest source. We did also find, to be fair, that open source software communication was not as profane as Twitter, just generic mm-hmm. Twitter, nor was it as profane as network TV, even cable TV. So it's not as bad. Yeah. It's bad, but yeah. It's not that bad. It's also, you know, we have to take our demographics into account. So this is if you believe that it's a 98.5% male or 90% male, whatever figure you come up with, then that is a different type of data set that we may not have from other places. It's also a data set of geeks talking. It's also a workplace data set. So there's a couple of different ways you could spin this data that are interesting.
And so as we you know close out our time, so we have maybe about 4 minutes left. Tell us a bit about. I mean, there's a lot here, obviously, and I do look forward to having you back to talk about how you ultimately organize 43,000 data sets and what phrase or word you came up to describe this, although it may be also a four-letter word at the end of all of it. So let me ask you this. So tell us a bit as we close out about your time frame for this project, when we can expect to see even preliminary results and where it goes from here.
So the data's been collected for over 10 years. It's all out on flossmole.org. flossmole.org. And anybody can download it. You don't need a license. You don't need to sign up. You don't even need to log in. Just go get the data. It's mm-hmm. sitting there in big old files. You can go get that. If you want to, you know, mess with it on a database, you can ask for a login and I'll give you one and you can write SQL queries all day. So that's all, freely available for anybody. In the future, we're going to be adding to that set. So all of these data sets that I've been collecting. And by the way, there's more than 43,000 even as we're talking right now because we're running code. It's running in my office.
As we speak.
As we speak. I literally have another student, Andrea, who's running, she's collecting all the IRC messages from one of the language communities. Anyway, so it's constantly getting bigger. We clean that data, we put it out. So if you, there's a little bit of delay there while we clean it and organize it and stuff like that. But the data does end up out for anyone to look at. The grant project runs for 3 years, and so that one will enable some of this work. We might move servers or things like that, or get bigger hard drives. I always need bigger hard drives, but swap out our machines and things like that. But the access to the data, it just gets bigger.
What occurs to me, and this will really be more of a point or a question, and I should have it up in front of me. But there have been some applications that used to run and still run on computers that allow you to basically offer your computing power when your computer's idle. Is this a project that you could hook up with? You don't have for it to
There's like the ones for SETI.
Exactly. Yes.
So running this stuff in a distributed way, that's certainly doable. I haven't done that in the past. The closest I've gotten was when I was running really big collectors against some of the open source forges. I would pull don't tell the IT people that you on this, but I'd pull one of the.
We're on the radio.
I'd pull one of the computer labs, and I would just load the software on all that, and 30 machines, we'd get it done in a couple hours. But I don't really I reorganize the way that I collect now, so I don't have that problem. But that's a really interesting point. I think when we get to the analysis steps, and we need to be churning through 80 million email messages, that kind of stuff, for building some massive classifier or something like that. That could be cool. I'm going to leave that to the analysts, though.
There we go. More open questions for later. Professor Megan Squire from Elon University's Computer Science Department, author of the later on forthcoming book, which was just signed today, called Clean Data. Also the curator, if you will, of this gigantic set of open source data. Congratulations on the NSF grant. Congratulations on the book. I invite you back on the show. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture to talk about this work, and I look forward to hearing about the results.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
So we have a number of guests coming up on the show in the coming weeks. I'm going to be recording a few shows as I move my mobile recorder from Greensboro, North Carolina to Princeton, New Jersey. And so I will be interviewing next week Professor Ed Felton, who runs the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton, where I'm affiliated this year. I'll be interviewing Alex Glazer and Zia Meon, two of the four authors of the book that just came out, Unmaking the Bomb, A Fissile Material Approach to Nuclear Disarmament and Nonproliferation. It's a fascinating book about how to think about nuclear disarmament in this era based upon the history, production, stockpiles, and current military and civilian uses of plutonium and highly enriched uranium. A fascinating book that it's a great book, but it'll make for excellent radio. Alex is an assistant professor in the Wilson School and in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at Princeton. Zia Meon is a research scientist and director of the Project on Peace and Security in South Asia, also at the Wilson School. And so one of the things I'm going to be doing over the coming months is taking advantage of my time at Princeton to interview the range of people, which is quite endless and quite remarkable, and really a candy store for someone like me and someone who does radio and IP and technology. In addition, coming up are going to be Biela Coleman's new book, and we're going to talk to her about her book on Anonymous. We're also going to be chatting with Lisa Lynch, who's a fellow at Princeton, and talking about her work on a variety of leak websites, ranging from the more well-known ones like WikiLeaks to a mafia and organized crime leak website that's based in Italy. And I will be talking to other guests as the opportunities arise. One thing that you would know, again, if you're paying attention to Hearsay Culture, I've been dealing with hackers myself. Hopefully none of those hackers are part of the community of open source coders that I hope they're not. I expect that they're not, that Megan's working with, although if Megan knows them, I'd appreciate her putting them in touch with me. The wonderful work, and I'm going to say this out loud because I want to give credit, and I've done this before, but my friend Oliver Day, who was a Berkman Fellow and who has founded an organization on which I'm a board member called Securing Change, where he's focused on helping nonprofit websites deal with hackers, has done amazing work in not only rooting out the bad code, but also at least putting a placeholder website up on the web in place of what was there. Oliver's work has been truly a godsend to me. He has done it completely free of charge, which is his want, but I'm very grateful for it. Having said that, I'm going to be working on fixing that website and making it more robust in the coming few weeks. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen this quarter at 10 a.m. Pacific time on Thursdays on KZSU-FM Stanford, which you can stream live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by going to the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, by going to the iTunes page for CIS. Also, the show is now airing on Free Rock Radio, Innsbruck, Austria, which is airing the show on occasion, where you can also get German language bumpers to the show, which is not something I ever anticipated Hearsay Culture would have, but now it does. And you can get the show through a variety of the podcast aggregating websites that are out there, from Player FM to TuneIn and on and on. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.